Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A hung parliament sends sterling, government bonds and the stock market falling. But how will it affect your finances in the longer term? Could the Greek debt crisis spread to the UK? We assess the risks to private investors. And how to become a truly global investor? FT Money columnist Nick Louth explains the ins and outs of managing your money from around the world. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent. I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Tanya Poley.
Hello.
And Ellen Kelleher.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. On Friday morning, the UK woke up to a hung parliament for the first time in more than 30 years. On current projections of the general election voting, the Conservatives will be 21 seats short of the 326 needed for an overall majority. But even a Labour and Lib Dem coalition looks likely to fall short of this number as well. So with no party able to declare victory or form a government on Friday morning, the FTSE 250 index, which is seen as more representative of the domestic UK economy, lost 2.5%. Benchmark gilts also fell, pushing yields up by nearly 17 basis points, and sterling weakened against the euro to €1.15. So what does this all mean for your investments, or is it too early to tell? Tanya, let's start off with what's been happening to sterling. A lot of people said sterling's pricing in a hung parliament, it won't fall any further, but it has fallen.
Yes, it has. Sterling has actually hit a one-year low against the dollar of $1.45. We've also seen sterling fall 3% against the euro to €1.15. I was speaking to a few currency experts today, and they're all of the opinion that, you know, if there isn't any kind of true agreement hammered out over the weekend, if there's still so much uncertainty going on in the markets, we could actually see sterling fall further come Monday, maybe to, you know, the €1.10 level and the $1.42. So it really is kind of quite bad news.
So it does all depend on whether Messrs Cameron and Clegg or Brown and Clegg or any other permutation can reach an agreement and quickly. Ellen, of course, sterling is going to affect UK share prices as well. Multinational companies with overseas earnings stand to do quite well, so FTSE 100 companies. But I mentioned earlier that the FTSE 250, which is full of sort of UK-based companies, has fallen quite a long way. What do people think is going to happen over the sort of medium term?
Well, there seems to be a real desire to go for global players right now. At least that's what fund managers are saying. I mean, you do have the situation where 70% of the companies that are listed on the FTSE 100 derive most of their earnings from overseas. So that means they're not really that affected if the sterling falls in value. And then to compound that, you have the weakness of the euro, which is actually good for European corporations. So a lot of fund managers are saying, well, actually, this blowout might present a buying opportunity in some ways. But there is still this fear that the FTSE 100 could fall to 4,500 or below. And we haven't seen that for some time. So that's a real fear factor for a lot of investors.
So risk on the downside for equity investors still. What about people holding gilts or corporate bonds? We've seen gilts fall in price, the yields going up this morning, Friday. Could they fall further?
Obviously, we're facing this sovereign debt crisis as well in southern Europe, and the concern is that could spread to the UK market. And the uncertainty hanging over the elections here has actually pushed up the price of yields on 10-year gilts too, with some analysts speculating they could rise to 4.5%. And that's, you know, quite a high number, and that would push, obviously, if yields rise and prices fall, and that creates a bit of a chaotic situation in the debt markets.
And just finally, if yields go up on gilts, that also has a knock-on effect on interest rates, could affect mortgages. Tanya, what does that mean for house prices?
I think people, housing experts, seem to be a bit concerned really about the outcome of the hung parliament. We've seen kind of a lot of people a bit nervous in the upcoming months to the election. A lot of people have been sitting on the fence, waiting to see what happens. And still, obviously, we haven't had any more certainty. So I think pretty much most people are predicting that house prices either remain flat or could even dip.
And we saw the Halifax house price index go down a little bit on Friday, didn't we?
Yes, that's right. Halifax said today that house prices in April actually dipped by 0.1%. And they're actually predicting that it will remain flat during 2010.
So we're unlikely to see prices of houses, shares, bonds moving up very fast for some time yet. Thanks, Tanya and Ellen. And you'll find all the latest news on the likely makeup of a new government on FT.com over the coming days. And we'll be assessing the immediate impact of the hung parliament on your personal finances in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, how to trade UK shares from the middle of the desert or in the Andes. We'll be joined by globe-trotting columnist Nick Louth. First, though, the European government debt crisis. This week, the scale of the debt problems in Greece took on a new dimension as three people died in rioting over the severe austerity measures being introduced to cut the budget deficit. But with Italy and Spain in even more debt than Greece, and Britain's budget deficit widening at a faster rate than any EU country, there are fears that the debt contagion could spread through European bond markets and even into equity markets. Ellen, you've been assessing the impact on UK investors. Is it simply a question of avoiding government bonds?
No, I think there's a lot of fear out there that this is going to spread to corporate bonds and could hit investment grade bond yields as well. Basically, the way the bond markets work is they're very connected. So, for example, the Portuguese government debt and Greece's government debt is owned by banks. So in the first case scenario, you have to question whether it's safe to hold the debt of banks that have exposure to the public debt of these countries that appear to be on the brink of a financial crisis. Moving on, you have to then look at which corporate bonds have exposure to the banks that have exposure to the government debt. So it's really a domino effect that most investors face when there's a crisis in the debt markets. And the flip side to this argument is that Greece is a small economy in comparison to its neighbors, and therefore it's easy to sort of limit the effects of what's happening there. But a lot of skeptics say that doesn't really hold ground, and we've already seen the yields rise and prices fall on Portugal's debt and Ireland's debt and Italy's debt and Spanish debt. So why shouldn't it spread further as the economy or as the crisis widens?
So there's the danger of this domino effect. As you say, we've already seen the yields on these government bonds rise as the prices fall. What does that mean for the UK investor who's holding a bond fund?
The UK investor who's holding a bond fund should be very careful that they're holding a well-diversified bond fund with a great deal of its holdings in the corporate side of the market. And even those investors face some risks, and they might want to consider getting out of those sorts of funds. There's definitely a lot of fear and danger sort of being advertised about debt markets, and corporate bonds are not likely to be immune.
But if people want to maintain some holdings in the fixed income sector, perhaps income investors need, you know, a certain degree of yield from their investments. Are there some bond funds that are considered better than others or more protected against sovereign debt contagion than others?
Definitely. I mean, they're the sort of the kind of the old standouts still are sought after, sort of Invesco Perpetuals Income Fund, the Artemis Income Fund, Legal & General's Income Fund. These funds don't have as big a percentage of their portfolios in Eurozone denominated debt. And as of now, we haven't, the contagion effect hasn't spread to the UK. And in fact, gilts are seeing some benefit from the crisis because they're seen as a safe haven. And the idea is that if debt is being issued outside of the Eurozone, it's a much better bet than debt held is sort of issued within the Eurozone. So if you can just stay away from the Eurozone, you're sort of better off.
So it could even be a better idea to be in a fund that holds UK gilts.
Oh, definitely, yes. But of course, there is this kind of specter hanging over the market, and UK gilts could suffer knock-on effects if 3 months from now the Spanish debt markets collapse and the Portuguese debt markets collapse and the Italian debt markets collapse, and then the UK is not going to be immune in a situation like that.
So no total immunity if you're a bond fund investor. Ellen, thanks very much for running through those risks with us. And for more details on the European debt crisis and what it may mean for your bond fund holdings, look out for Ellen's article in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. And finally today, investing around the world. 6 months ago, Nick Louth, one of the contributors to FT Money's long-running My Portfolio column, decided to take the trip of a lifetime, a six-month around-the-world odyssey with his wife, taking in Southeast Asia, Australia and South America, as well as all points in between. But being an avid private investor, Nick decided to try to keep track of the stock market and his share portfolio using just a small laptop computer. How did he get on? Well, as soon as he landed back at Heathrow, we brought him straight to our podcast studio to find out. Nick, you're just back from 5.5 months trekking to far-flung parts of the world, while, of course, still looking after your share portfolio for your My Portfolio column. So for those listeners who haven't been following your travels through the column, just remind us where you've been and how you did stay in touch with what's going on in the world's financial markets.
Well, I essentially went round the world. I started in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, went through Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and then to Australasia, went to both New Zealand and Australia, and then on to Chile. The monitoring was something that you couldn't have done 15 years ago this way. It was entirely through the internet. In countries that you perhaps wouldn't think of as being tremendously advanced societies 10 years ago have some of the best internet connections. You can imagine a country like Laos or Chile, even in the Atacama Desert, you can get a better signal in small towns on the edge of the Atacama Desert than you can in small towns in outback of Victoria in Australia, surprisingly enough. So it was through the internet that I managed to do this. And I'm glad to say that there were no really horrible surprises. There was one share that I probably should have sold before I went, and that became a bit of a headache for me, and that was an Australian oil explorer called ROC. This company originally had a listing on AIM as well as in Australia, and they decided to terminate the AIM listing. And I thought, well, that's no problem. It's in my self-invested pension, and you can hold foreign shares. But in fact, I was also in the middle of trying to transfer my holding from one broker to another, and it caused a really big bureaucratic logjam that at sort of 20,000 miles away, I was unable to resolve.
Were you in Australia at the time?
Strangely enough, I was in Australia. So if I'd held my ROC shares in an Australian stockbroker, I could have actually phoned them up at the time and got rid of them. But in fact, because it was held in a British portfolio and they wouldn't take email instructions, I would have to phone them, and then they'd have to have put an open order out into a void, really, because the Australian market wouldn't open for some hours later. I wasn't prepared to do that. So that proved to be quite a bureaucratic headache. But that apart, it's proved to be a more pleasant experience than I feared it might be.
How did you look after all of these investments while in the middle of nowhere almost?
The main part of it was preparing beforehand a collection of shares that I knew I could monitor quite easily, that were not particularly risky and indeed had as many defensive possibilities as possible. The idea was to make as few transactions as possible while I was away. And indeed, I probably only did two transactions in the entire sort of 5.5 months.
So before you went, did you have to go through your holdings and say, is it okay to sit on this particular share
for
6 months? And did some go by the wayside? Did you get rid of some?
They did, yes. I mean, I sold a number of AIM-listed shares, things I probably should have sold anyway. It sort of brought matters to a head with a few different shares. But it also meant that I decided to put more money into some of the utility companies. I added to a holding in National Grid. I bought some shares in Scottish and Southern Electricity. These were all the kind of companies that I thought wouldn't let me down while I was away, and if any news item came up, I should at least be able to monitor it relatively easily.
And in terms of the other transactions you had to look after, I suppose there's the day-to-day stuff like paying the mortgage and paying the bills. Did you set all that up, you know, automatically, or did you actually handle that using your internet connection in your laptop?
Pretty much. It was all set up for direct debits beforehand. There were the things that you decided were, you know, the mortgage council tax and heating bills were still on direct debit. I'm hoping to get a serious rebate when we get home on the heating bills, because they continue to take money out at the same rate as if we were still there.
You missed quite a
difficult winter. I don't think it would be quite enough to pay for the entire cost of the trip, but that would be nice. The other things that were slightly ticklish were the internet access, where the cost of actually cancelling the line for 6 months would have been greater than the savings I'd made on the monthly payment. So I actually continued to run that. Same kind of thing with the telephone line. But overall, it was relatively simple because most of the bills are on direct debit anyway. It's the unexpected things that you have to be much more careful about. And again, that's where the internet, you know, gives you some clue of what's happening. I'd made my arrangements with the tax authorities in advance and made an advance payment on the financial year's tax payments to their satisfaction, and would claim any rebate. Always pay them slightly more than they expect, and then you can collect a rebate later on, keeps them happy.
But you weren't sat there in the middle of the desert doing your self-assessment tax return?
No, not at all. No, I'd done that before I went, I sent a letter to the tax people explaining what I was doing and why they would be seeing a seriously smaller slice of tax from me in the coming years. I've not worked for the best part of 6 months, and then asked them how much money they'd want in advance of the tax deadline in January, and made those arrangements, and that seemed to work fine. I may come home and find that there's a letter steaming for me on the doormat, but so far as I know, it's all worked out well.
That sounds good. And just very, very quickly, do you think that going away for 5.5 months round the world has actually left your finances in a better or worse position?
Well, clearly there's a major cost to going around the world for 5.5 months. On the other hand, the investment portfolio has performed quite well in that time and made up a good part of the difference.
Excellent, Nick. Thank you very much for coming here,
Thank you, Matthew, first of all,
to tell us all about it. That was FT Money columnist Nick Louth talking on his return to the UK earlier this week. And for this week's My Portfolio column, pick up a copy of FT Money with the weekend FT, or visit ft.com/money. Nick's next column will appear on Saturday, May the 22nd. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember that you can find weekday news updates, including the election latest, on our website, ft.com/money. And you can read and comment on our latest blog posts at ft.com/moneymatters. We'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tanya and Ellen.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Whether Messrs Cameron and Clegg, or Brown and Clegg, or any other permutation, can reach an agreement and quickly. Ellen, of course, sterling is going to affect UK share prices as well. Multinational companies with overseas earnings stand to do quite well, so FTSE 100 companies. But I mentioned earlier that the FTSE 250, which is full of sort of UK-based companies, has fallen quite a long way. What do people think is going to happen over the sort of medium term?
Well, there seems to be a real desire to go for global players right now. At least that's what fund managers are saying. I mean, you do have the situation where 70% of the companies that are listed on the FTSE 100 derive most of their earnings from overseas. So that means they're not really that affected if the sterling falls in value. And then to compound that, you have the weakness of the euro, which is actually good for European corporations. So a lot of fund managers are saying, well, actually, this blowout might present a buying opportunity in some ways. But there is still this fear that the FTSE 100 could fall to 4,500 or below. And we haven't seen that for some time. So that's a real fear factor for a lot of investors.
So risk on the downside for equity investors still. What about people holding gilts or corporate bonds? We've seen gilts fall in price, their yields going up this morning, Friday. Could they fall further?
Obviously, we're facing this sovereign debt crisis as well in southern Europe. And the concern is that could spread to the UK market. And the uncertainty hanging over the elections here has actually pushed up the price of yields on 10-year gilts to, with some analysts speculating, they could rise to 4.5%. And that's quite a high number, and that would push, obviously, if yields rise and prices fall, and that creates a bit of a chaotic situation in the debt markets.
And just finally, if yields go up on gilts, that also has a knock-on effect on interest rates, could affect mortgages. Tanya, what does that mean for house prices?
I think housing experts seem to be a bit concerned, really, about the outcome of the Hung Parliament. We've seen kind of a lot of people a bit nervous in the upcoming months to the election. A lot of people have been sitting on the fence, waiting to see what happens. And still, obviously, we haven't had any more certainty. So I think pretty much most people are predicting that house prices either remain flat or could even dip.
And we saw the Halifax House Price Index go down a little bit on Friday, didn't we?
Yes, that's right. Halifax said today that house prices in April actually dipped by 0.1%. And they're actually predicting that it will remain flat during 2010.
So I'm likely to see prices of houses, shares, bonds moving up very fast for some time yet. Thanks, Tanya and Ellen. And you'll find all the latest news on the likely makeup of a new government on FT.com over the coming days. And we'll be assessing the immediate impact of the Hung Parliament on your personal finances in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, how to trade UK shares from the middle of the desert or in the Andes. We'll be joined by globe-trotting columnist Nick Louth. First, though, the European government debt crisis. This week, the scale of the debt problems in Greece took on a new dimension as three people died in rioting over the severe austerity measures being introduced to cut the budget deficit. But with Italy and Spain in even more debt than Greece, and Britain's budget deficit widening at a faster rate than any EU country, there are fears that the debt contagion could spread through European bond markets and even into equity markets. Ellen, you've been assessing the impact on UK investors. Is it simply a question of avoiding government bonds?
No, I think there's a lot of fear out there that this is going to spread to corporate bonds and could hit investment grade bond yields as well. Basically, the way the bond markets work is they're very connected. So, for example, the Portuguese government debt and Greece's government debt is owned by banks. So in the first case scenario, you have to question whether it's safe to hold the debt of banks that have exposure to the public debt of these countries that appear to be on the brink of a financial crisis. Moving on, you have to then look at which corporate bonds have exposure to the banks that have exposure to the government debt. So it's really a domino effect that most investors face when there's a crisis in the debt markets. And the flip side to this argument is that Greece is a small economy in comparison to its neighbors, and therefore it's easy to sort of limit the effects of what's happening there. But a lot of skeptics say that doesn't really hold ground, and we've already seen the yields rise and prices fall on Portugal's debt and Ireland's debt and Italy's debt and Spanish debt. So why shouldn't it spread further as the economy or as the crisis widens?
So there is the danger of this domino effect. As you say, we've already seen the yields on these government bonds rise as the prices fall. What does that mean for the UK investor who's holding a bond fund?
The UK investor who's holding a bond fund should be very careful that they're holding a well-diversified bond fund with a great deal of its holdings in the corporate side of the market. And even those investors face some risks, and they might want to consider getting out of those sorts of funds. There's definitely a lot of fear and danger sort of being advertised about debt markets, and corporate bonds are not likely to be immune.
But if people want to maintain some holdings in the fixed income sector, perhaps income investors need, you know, a certain degree of yield from their investments. Are there some bond funds that are considered better than others or more protected against sovereign debt contagion than others?
Definitely. I mean, they're the sort of the kind of the old standouts still are sought after, sort of Invesco Perpetuals Income Fund, the Artemis Income Fund, Legal & General's Income Fund. These funds don't have as big a percentage of their portfolios in Eurozone denominated debt. And as of now, the contagion effect hasn't spread to the UK. And in fact, gilts are seeing some benefit from the crisis because they're seen as a safe haven. And the idea is that if debt is being issued outside of the Eurozone, it's a much better bet than debt held is sort of issued within the Eurozone. So if you can just stay away from the Eurozone, you're sort of better off.
So it could even be a better idea to be in a fund that holds UK gilts.
Oh, definitely, yes. But, of course, there is this kind of spectre hanging over the market, and UK gilts could suffer knock-on effects if 3 months from now the Spanish debt markets collapse and the Portuguese debt markets collapse and the Italian debt markets collapse, then the UK is not going to be immune in a situation like that.
So no total immunity if you're a bond fund investor. Ellen, thanks very much for running through those risks with us. And for more details on the European debt crisis and what it may mean for your bond fund holdings, look out for Ellen's article in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. And finally today, investing around the world. 6 months ago, Nick Louth, one of the contributors to FT Money's long-running My Portfolio column, decided to take the trip of a lifetime, a six-month around-the-world odyssey with his wife, taking in Southeast Asia, Australia and South America, as well as all points in between. But being an avid private investor, Nick decided to try to keep track of the stock market and his share portfolio using just a small laptop computer. How did he get on? Well, as soon as he landed back at Heathrow, we brought him straight to our podcast studio to find out. Nick, you're just back from 5.5 months trekking to far-flung parts of the world, while of course still looking after your share portfolio for your My Portfolio column. So for those listeners who haven't been following your travels through the column, just remind us where you've been and how you did stay in touch with what's going on in the world's financial markets.
Well, I essentially went round the world. I started in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, went through Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and then to Australasia, went to both New Zealand and Australia, and then on to Chile. The monitoring was something that you couldn't have done 15 years ago this way. It was entirely through the internet. In countries that you perhaps wouldn't think of as being tremendously advanced societies 10 years ago have some of the best internet connections you can imagine. A country like Laos or Chile, even in the Atacama Desert, you can get a better signal in small towns on the edge of the Atacama Desert than you can in small towns in outback of Victoria in Australia, surprisingly enough. So it was through the internet that I managed to do this. And I'm glad to say that there were no really horrible surprises. There was one share that I probably should have sold before I went, and that became a bit of a headache for me, and that was an Australian oil explorer called Rock. This company originally had a listing on AIM as well as in Australia, and they decided to terminate the AIM listing. And I thought, well, that's no problem. It's in my self-invested pension, and you can hold foreign shares. But in fact, I was also in the middle of trying to transfer my holding from one broker to another, and it caused a really big bureaucratic logjam that at sort of 20,000 miles away, I was unable to resolve.
Were you in Australia at the time?
Strangely enough, I was in Australia. So if I'd held my Rock shares in an Australian stockbroker, I could have actually phoned them up at the time and got rid of them. But in fact, because it was held in a British portfolio and they wouldn't take email instructions, I would have to phone them, and then they'd have to have put an open order out into a void, really, because the Australian market wouldn't open for some hours later. I wasn't prepared to do that. So that proved to be quite a bureaucratic headache. But that apart, it's proved to be a more pleasant experience than I feared it might be.
How did you look after all of these investments while in the middle of nowhere, almost?
The main part of it was preparing beforehand a collection of shares that I knew I could monitor quite easily, that were not particularly risky and indeed had as many defensive possibilities as possible. The idea was to make as few transactions as possible while I was away. And indeed, I probably only did two transactions in the entire sort of 5.5 months.
So before you went, did you have to go through your holdings and say, is it okay to sit on this particular share
for
6 months? And did some go by the wayside? Did you get rid of some?
They did, yes. I mean, I sold a number of AIM-listed shares, things I probably should have sold anyway. It sort of brought matters to a head with a few different shares. But it also meant that I decided to put more money into some of the utility companies. I added to a holding in National Grid. I bought some shares in Scottish and Southern Electricity. These were all the kind of companies that I thought wouldn't let me down while I was away, and if any news item came up, I should at least be able to monitor it relatively easily.
And in terms of the other transactions you had to look after, I suppose there's the day-to-day stuff like paying the mortgage and paying the bills. Did you set all that up, you know, automatically, or did you actually handle that using your internet connection?
Pretty much it was all set up for direct debits beforehand. There were the things that you decided were, you know, the mortgage council tax and the heating bills were still on direct debit. I'm hoping to get a serious rebate when we get home on the heating bills, because they continue to take money out at the same rate as if we were still there.
You missed quite a
difficult winter. I don't think it would be quite enough to pay for the entire cost of the trip, but that would be nice. The other things that were slightly ticklish were the internet access, where the cost of actually cancelling the line for 6 months would have been greater than the savings I'd made on the monthly payment. So I actually continued to run that. Same kind of thing with the telephone line. But overall, it was relatively simple because most of the bills are on direct debit anyway. It's the unexpected things that you have to be much more careful about. And again, that's where the internet, you know, gives you some clue of what's happening. I'd made my arrangements with the tax authorities in advance and made an advance payment on the financial year's tax payments to their satisfaction, and would claim any rebate. Always pay them slightly more than they expect, and then you can collect a rebate later on, keeps them happy.
But you weren't sat there in the middle of the desert doing your self-assessment tax return?
No, not at all. No, I'd done that before I went, I sent a letter to the tax people explaining what I was doing and why they would be seeing a seriously smaller slice of tax from me in the coming years. I've not worked for the best part of 6 months, and then asked them how much money they'd want in advance of the tax deadline in January, and made those arrangements, and that seemed to work fine. I may come home and find that there's a letter steaming for me on the doormat, but so far as I know, it's all worked out well.
That sounds good. And just very, very quickly, do you think that going away for 5.5 months round the world has actually left your finances in a better or worse position?
Well, clearly there's a major cost to going around the world for 5.5 months. On the other hand, the investment portfolio has performed quite well in that time and made up a good part of the difference.
Excellent. Nick, thank you very much for coming here,
first of all,
to tell us all about it. That was FT Money columnist Nick Louth talking on his return to the UK earlier this week. And for this week's My Portfolio column, pick up a copy of FT Money with the Weekend FT or visit ft.com/money. Next column will appear on Saturday, May the 22nd. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember that you can find weekday news updates, including the election latest, on our website, ft.com/money. And you can read and comment on our latest blog posts at ft.com/moneymatters. We'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tanya and Ellen.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.